Hello and welcome to Remainders, where we discuss movies, old movies, new movies, weird movies, documentary movies about weird gaming nerds that we're going to talk about today. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Patrick McIntyre. And Pat, how are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. I'm so excited to talk about this movie with you. How about you?
I am doing great. And this is the first time I think that I've watched the film that you've suggested before the due date, because I literally had so much time on my hands and I'm like, I'm really interested in this film. What is this all about? King of Kong, trying to explain it to people before I even knew anything about it. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's about King Kong or whatever. And then I realized, no, it's about the video game industry and sort of the championships that ensue. And then I watched it, not being a gaming nerd myself. I didn't know if I would enjoy it, but holy shit, did I. There's so much to talk about in this film, and I'm sure you're raring to go.
Oh, man. Okay. So I am very excited that you enjoyed it, because this is certainly one of my favorite documentaries. I mean, I have many favorite documentaries, but this is way up there on the list. Certainly one of my most rewatched movies. I mean, this is a pretty short film. I think it's like only an hour and 20 minutes. So it definitely fits into your schedule this week if you had some extra time. And just over the years since I saw it, this has been a repeat viewing, certainly every year since then, because this is definitely a comfort movie for me. But yeah, the movie we're talking about is the 2007 documentary King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, which is a subtitle that I actually really, really love. Definitely fits right into it. But yeah, I mean, really quick, this is the story of two men vying for the top score in the 1981 arcade video game Donkey Kong, the original, like the very first like Mario game, came out around the same time as Pac-Man. Billy Mitchell is the reigning champion for years of Donkey Kong. And in 2006, Steve Wiebe, I think I'm pronouncing that right. I know that's probably
he makes sure that everybody knows the pronunciation right. It's Wiebe. Yeah, he said that.
He manages to break the top score. Unfortunately, this kind of exposes a level of corruption amongst the Twin Galaxies gaming corporation, which is like kind of the mecca of work where top scores are held. And his exposure of this top score really shows the level of kind of purposeful deceit in the gaming world for these top scores for classic gaming. And so I'm certainly making it sound to be like much more serious a film than it is, because this is a funny fucking movie. And it really is the fact that it takes such a seemingly trivial subject matter and turns it into such a great story about power and creative and skillful aspirations that one incorporates in their lives.
Yeah, you know, I have to say too, it's always fun to talk about the time period of which these films are made, right? So you're talking in 2007, it came out, and you think about the technology that was around during that time, right? So a lot of times in this documentary, as I'm sure you'll see, anybody who hasn't seen it before, you know, you're not looking at people in a time where cell phones were around. You're looking at a time when they had to have camcorders mounted, you know, on a tripod to film them beating the game or getting the high score. And then they would take these tapes and send it in. So if you couldn't be there in person, which is the thing to do, you know, if you want to be a real champion, you've got to beat people, you know, in a setting where you could be people are holding your looking over your shoulder as you're playing. You know, there's a lot of pressure in the sort of public forum to play these games and the public championships, but a lot of these records are being held by people who are filming them beating the game, getting the high score. And that's where the sort of trouble comes in here, because the current holder, Billy Williams, who is somebody I can't wait to dive into this character.
Billy Mitchell,
of course. I'm thinking of the pitch man, Billy Williams from back in the day. But the Billy Mitchell is like the classic Midwest businessman. Won't give up. I think his quote from like then until now is like, don't give up ever. He wears United States flag ties. This guy is like the businessman that will not give up, and he does not want to acquiesce to losing ever. And so he's going to have something up his sleeve for the Steve Wiebe character, who comes in and has submitted a tape that said he's now the high scorer on Donkey Kong, unseating the longstanding reigning champion that has been there for since the beginning. So this is a big deal in the gaming world. And like I said, it's very timely. The fact that this documentary is happening, it's happening right on the cusp of this Donkey Kong unseating, which has taken years to do. And it's pitting two men against each other, really, that couldn't be more different, right? You know, you got Billy over on one hand, who is sort of like obsessed with power. He's this egomaniac because he's the champion. He found the one thing that he got accolades for and has milked it ever since. He's turned it into a big business for his chicken wings, his hot sauce chicken wing business. You know, he's used this thing to sort of go off and make a living for himself. So anything that challenges his Donkey Kong win is really, really, really not cool for his life. And so the other hand, we have Steve Wiebe, like you said, who's a family man. It doesn't bother him when his kids are yelling at him while he's playing in Donkey Kong. He's kind of down on his luck. He's kind of like a lot of us artists out there. He has a, you know, real big skill in music, but he hasn't really done anything with it. He was a really good pitcher, but he kind of flaked under the pressure. It's really interesting that they set it up that way, because they're really setting up to, that this guy is now got the thing that he's really good at, all these other things he was really good at, but he just couldn't quite get there and be a champion. But now in Donkey Kong, this man can be a champion. And like I said, it's two different people. It's really two different characters that we're seeing in this film pitted up against each other for the win.
Well, I mean, you're setting up this conflict so perfectly. I'm sure for everybody who's seen the film, it definitely that resonates with them the most. And if you haven't seen the film, this really is the core of like why this movie works so well. So like maybe taking a step back, like, so this is one of two documentaries that we're going to watch. And I definitely wanted both of these because I find them to be both pretty inspired, especially our second movie, but this one very much so inspired by one of your favorites, American Movie, which we watched for the podcast. And it really does capture that kind of working class aspiration for either a creative or an artistic endeavor, because it's meaningful for them. It gives them purpose. It gives them a fulfilling sense of duty and artistic expression. And we watch with the struggles and the sacrifice that they put in through it, and that's really what these two documentaries are going to kind of follow through. And so that is kind of the Steve character. He really is the person we're rooting for, because his pursuit is one, even though like I'm certainly not going for any world records in Donkey Kong, but I definitely am rooting for him. And a large part of it is because Billy Mitchell is like such a fucking great villain. Like he really is a top tier villain. And that's a huge reason why this movie works so well, because he is definitely so charismatic to watch. Not so much like him being charismatic, but like the narrative that the director sets up with between these two is just one that I absolutely love.
I mean, the world loves assholes. The world loves, you know, people that are crazy, because that is the stuff that's worth watching. I mean, why is like the Netflix documentary on this Alex Murdaugh guy going fucking bonkers right now? Why is that trial going bonkers? Why is everybody so glued to that shit? It's because this can't be, he's so fucking crazy. How could this be real? You know, how could, and like, of course, the thing with Billy Mitchell in this, like you said, he's a great villain, but why is he a great villain? Because we all know this guy. We all know this guy. Right. Just like, you know, I use this phrase that I used to see that was in my dad's Pace of Business all these years ago. And I remember seeing it and I still think about it today. It's like when a little shot gets a half shot, he thinks he's a big shot. And that's Billy Mitchell, in my opinion. I mean, he got some accolades, and I'm not saying he doesn't work hard, and I'm not saying that he's not, you know, good at what he does. I'm saying though, he has these tactics that he's built on from one accolade in his life and he's used it. Maybe that's more common than not, but he really goes and makes him, he does, this is like a big business trip that happens with people. Once you are in a place of power, you back out and you don't let anybody see you. You don't talk to anybody. Like if you're the champion, you have like a gopher in front of you that goes and does all of your business for you. That's your ears on the street. That's your eyes on the street. And then you sit back and you kind of say, okay. And then you're like the Svengali of it in the back, but nobody ever sees you. And this happens with Billy Mitchell in this big time. And it's so, and as the audience, we're watching and we're like, are you going to show up to the tournament? You got to defend your name, but he doesn't give a shit. He's in control in his mind. He's this power hungry maniac that knows he's the champion and he's convinced himself. That's another thing that happens where I feel with, you know, people in business is that even if it's a lie, it's a lie that they've told themselves that they're going to believe. And as soon as they tell themselves that they're going to believe it, they never let go of it. They always, anybody could challenge you high and low, but you're never, ever going to say that you're wrong. And that's Billy Mitchell here. I don't feel like up until this day, there's still lawsuits going on right now against him. And like the fact that he probably cheated in the, and you know, all the way back to 2005 or whatever it is. And he's not saying he ever, he'll never say he did. Kind of reminds me of one of our presidents that we used to have here a year ago, a couple years ago.
So perfectly put. So yeah, Brian Koo is the minion who's doing all the legwork. And this is such a great douchebag character. As you're saying, like his ears, eyes and ears on the ground. And again, it really is the direction from Seth Gordon, who went on to like Hollywood comedy films and TV and whatnot. He's directed like episodes of The Office. He directed that movie Horrible Bosses, which is, you know, pretty funny. It's got a great performance from Colin Farrell as this shitbag supervisor. So, and this was an early movie from Seth Gordon. And so you can see like, that's a huge reason why this works so well, because the editing and the narrative structure that he unfolded. This was originally a documentary just solely about the video game mecha of Twin Galaxies. It's called Chasing Ghosts, I believe. It was still released, but like that was the documentary that he was in, like set out to make. And then this kind of conflict between Steve and Billy Mitchell kind of unfolded while he was making it. And so that's kind of like why
like the organic, like that's like the gold, right? Like you can't expect, right?
Where he it was just really like a true example of like somebody filming a documentary and then the story changes because events change and characters are uncovered, and thankfully that's he kept that going because we got this amazing fucking documentary. But yeah, I mean, I fully subscribe to how much this one is just really a an underdog story. And again, that's kind of a lot of what I got out of American Movie and why I love that one so much. And I'm assuming that's what you responded to so much into that one over the years. It really is the underdog story that kept these movies going and why this one was such a powerful impact on me. So I mean, I saw this pretty quickly after it came out, maybe 2008. I remember I saw a recommendation, might have been like Entertainment Weekly or something. Actors or directors were shown like their favorite movie of the year, and it was John C. Reilly who said this was like his favorite movie of the year. So like I hadn't heard about it at the time, and so I picked it up. I remember I got it from Netflix through the DVDs, which is how Netflix used to go. You actually get the DVD in the mail. And I remember that vividly because I remember keeping it for like several months because I just rewatched it so many times after I first saw that. And oh man, I was so happy to do that because this has stuck with me over the years. Like I said, it is because of the comedic element of the narrative story that really drives it home for me.
Yeah, I did a little research, you know, and usually through Wikipedia, you can see some things that have happened ever since the film came out. And I just love the fact that like a lot of it was like fact checking a lot of the shit that Billy said, you know, like the Red Baron stuff that he shot down like 87 guys or whatever it was. And they're like, yeah, actually, no, it was more like blah, blah, blah. I kind of just love that. Like people are sitting there bullshitting at this early, like nowadays you can't get away with like, well, you can, but a lot of people like, you know, prepare a little bit more when they're getting on camera and don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the things that are going on with, like, is it fraudulent? Is it not? I mean, Billy went after Steve because he had a board sent to him in the film. They show this, he had a board sent to him that he had to replace on his Donkey Kong machine. And that's when they said, I guess that's against the Twin Galaxies rules, that if you replace any kind of piece of, your console, then your, you know, record doesn't stand. So what does Steve Wiebe do? He goes and shows up in person and says, all right, fuck that, I'm going to beat this, and I'm going to show up in person, and even calls the current champion, Billy, and he goes, let's do this in person. And this is where, again, Billy doesn't show up. You know, he just decides to, like, send people out. And, like, one day he does show up, but it's just to walk past him and taunt him. It's just, like, insane. And it's under the umbrella of gaming, professional gaming. So, like, it's even more ridiculous if you think about it. It's like, this is the things that these people are taking seriously. And, you know, you think that, like, that kind of stuff happens in regular business day to day, but this is happening in the world of, like, Donkey Kong.
Yeah, no, I mean, this movie is about one thing. It's about power. And the power that Billy Mitchell exerts over the gaming industry from Twin Galaxies. I mean, he is the one who's on the board basically determining whether or not high scores and videotapes that are sent in are acceptable. And they're rejected for whatever reasons. Maybe there's fraudulence. Maybe somebody, like, tampered with the tape. And it really shows that, like, he's in on the decision-making that will affect, like, whether or not his high scores are maintained or not, or still recognized. And that's what really just keeps this story going and is so universal. I mean, because this is the story of, you know, largely most societies and how power works, how power is exerted over people in a way to maintain it for specific people and not for others. And so that's where the underdog story comes in, and it's just fucking great. It's so universal. I mean, we'll get into the music. The music is a big part of, like, why it's so such a watchable movie, but one of the final songs that they play is Everybody Knows by Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, and it's when I heard that, I was like, oh, Pat's gotta be going crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, there's plenty of great music in this movie. They start with The Cure and then end it with Leonard Cohen. But that song, Everybody Knows, I mean, it's, the lyrics, everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. It's like, it really is just driving home the story of how power is exerted over the powerless. And it's such a well-directed scene with that, when they're showing Billy kind of possibly getting prepped to, like, go head-to-head with Steve, but, you know, that doesn't come to fruition.
Well, the reason I brought that Alex Murdaugh thing is because I did watch that, like, Netflix series that just came out on that, and I just thought there was a lot of parallels, like you said, with the power dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, people who have money and are able to control situations, it always turns out to be, you know, the little people get shit on, right? Even if there's, like, loss of life here or anything like that, like, people can control the story through, you know, power, influence, money. It's a fucking shame. And a lot of times too, a lot of people who don't have a lot of help or are in a, you know, corner, because life can be that way where you just don't have the means to get ahead, can be controlled that way. And that's the scary thing, is that because no matter how, like, strong-willed you are, everybody can be controlled one way or the other based on their situation in life. And yeah. That is kind of an interesting thing to watch that series and watch this at the same time, because, like you said, this is, and I love that you said that, this is a film about power. And this story is everywhere, but we're just having to place it in the realm of championship video gaming.
Love it.
Yeah.
Now the subculture and all the various characters are definitely what keeps it such an entertaining pace. I want to know your take on Mr. Awesome and his incorporation. Well,
I sure did enjoy that text you sent me yesterday, because, you know, like, that guy, of course, is another character. It's just like some people are able to like go above and beyond with that. Like some people are smart that they know, like, okay, I got to be a character, and that's what is like everyone's gonna like latch on to. But for whatever reason, Mr. Awesome didn't have like anything else to back it up. He just like wanted to go overboard. But then like there wasn't any, like, again, he didn't have what Billy had. Billy was a champion, so Billy could be like a little bit of a crazy character, but still a little bit like reserved, you know, and able to do things. Like Mr. Awesome was like, I'm gonna make out this video, I'm gonna have like, you know, girls that are half naked in it, I'm gonna call myself Mr. Awesome, but yet he has no championship under his belt, right?
Well, he claims he has the Missile Command score.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is, I mean, again, like, who knows, like, who actually has it, but like, he claims that Twin Galaxies is corrupt with like the scores that they publish. And so if you haven't seen it, Roy Schultz ends up providing Steve with a board for him to play Donkey Kong as he was trying to beat Billy Mitchell's score. And once Twin Galaxies receive this score from Steve Weeb, they end up sending spies to like check out the machine that he worked on, or that he played the game on, and to see if it was worked on in any way. And they found out that it was provided by Roy Schultz, who they believe would like to see nothing more than Twin Galaxies kind of falter. And so it's through this kind of exertion of power, as we were saying, it's like, that's why they basically rejected Steve Weeby's score. And so like, you see all this shit, and this is all happening with Mr. Awesome, who's this pickup artist, trying to be this self-made man in the 80s with all these self-made videotapes. And it's just absolutely perfect personality for this type of movie, and actually coining Chumpetize, which is just an absolutely beautiful word. I mean, I looked it up. I mean, it actually is on Urban Dictionary, which is always a hilarious thing to still get on these days. But to turn someone into a chump, often used reflexively, earliest documented use is in director Seth Gordon's 2007 documentary, The King of Kong.
Oh man, that's like a laugh I haven't had in a while. That's amazing that it made it that far to chumpetize somebody. Unbelievable. So Mr.
Awesome, think about one thing, me helping him not turn him into a chump, out of chumpetizing himself.
And like, the whole thing is like, again, under the veil of championship video gaming. So it's also absurd. You've got these characters that are just after each other. And, you know, the pawn in the game that we get, that we're not talking about, is the referee. The guy who's actually like, would rather be a musician. The guy who started Twin Galaxies. I forget his name again. What do you remember? His name?
Walter Day.
Yeah. Who's awesome. He's just basically there to like be a real legit ref. However, he's a little influenced by the fact that Billy is the champ. And he's like, you know, you can tell at the beginning, they do make it pretty clear that everybody wants to be Billy's friend. Billy's the champ. Billy's been in all of the magazines. Billy's the guy that has won. He's succeeded. Nobody can beat Billy. So when a newcomer comes on, like Steve Weeby, he's like, oh, like, what do we do now? Like, there's some new person that might be better than him. Like, they are, like, they don't say it, but they are biased a little bit to Billy. And I feel like Walter is stuck in the middle, but he eventually does the right thing and lets Steve know, like, look, you showed up, you are a contender, and Billy didn't come to the championship, and I want to apologize for that. He sent him a letter, and you could see that he is like, he does have a conscience. He does have, you know, empathy for this scenario that's playing out. It just took him like a minute to kind of switch over to that. And I think it's really nice that the filmmakers did place Walter in the, you know, a farm. It looks like a simple guy and is really trying to just do something to build a community here. That's why he started Twin Galaxies and, you know, just kept going. But he also, you know, they're setting it up that like, he's a musician, that he, you know, he understands, even though it's obviously pretty funny when that scene comes on and he plays the song, like, you can understand that, like, he does have like a soul, a heart, you know, he's not like, this isn't big business for him.
Yes. And at the same time, he straight out says, like, it's in Twin Galaxies' interest to promote Billy Mitchell, because Billy Mitchell is a celebrity. Like, he's on you know, not like high level celebrity, but he's on like basic shows. He's certainly a celebrity in the gaming industry. So his name is recognizable. And as he says, it's like, it's in Twin Galaxies' interest to partner with him quite a bit and have him be part of that institution. And that's precisely where the corruption comes from. It's like just that them being in it together is like what leads to why the person with the highest score is on the board of deciding other people's high scores. And, right. and again, it's just like, it's so perfectly emblematic of like how so many societies work, which is
the other thing is like Billy saying like things like, you know, everybody asked me what my username is, you know, my three letters.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, if you have to ask me that, you're not looking hard enough, you know? And it's like, dude, geez, like, you know, that's like, you could see the ego coming out right from that. Like,
yeah. Oh, he's on the X show or something. And the guy's like, he's introducing him or greeting him. He's like, Billy, how are you? He's like, I'm perfect. Haven't you read?
Dude, yes. Yeah. And that, you know, the filmmakers were watching that and like, they're like, we gotta
get a camera on this guy as much as possible.
And you know that they were aware of the things that we're talking about solely because of the way that the camera moves sometimes too. Like when Billy did come into the room and it's stuck on Steve and they see Billy creep out from the side there with his wife and it zooms in on Billy, they're like completely aware of like what that energy is like in that room. And they want us to know, you know?
Yeah.
Amazing.
It comes in there with his, big boobed wife who straight out admits, no, I've never seen my husband compete head to head in a championship. So it's like, it's just in the gaming industry, he's held so much sway over people that he doesn't, you know, people don't even like question the fact that a lot of it may be a facade.
There are some like amazing things on his social media. And I was going to tell you before this, but like anybody watching, yeah, he has an Instagram and he'll write back to people who are like would question things and stuff like that. And it's incredible. Like it's, you know, I'm not going to reiterate it here because I don't know it verbatim, but it's really fun to read some of the comments on his Instagram.
So since this movie, so this was 2007. I mean, it has come out that there seems to be proof that he cheated.
Can we set up that scene really quick? So for the listeners out there, the big part of this that is like so questionable for us watching the film is that Steve Wiebe is at this championship and he does break the record and everybody sees him. There's no denying it. It's not like it's on like a you know, something he recorded in his house. He went above and beyond and beat his record that, you know, he mailed in whatever a month ago or whatever. So he's now twice beaten Billy. Billy's not at this thing. I forget what's called, Super Fun Land or some shit like that. And Billy doesn't come, but Billy sends with the Q-Bert, the 80-year-old Q-Bert like champion. He sends her, this is his gopher for this like event. He sends her with a tape of him allegedly being the first, million points, which like he has on video, and he only allows people to watch he's not even there, but he has them set up this TV, put in the tape, and he makes it like so elite that you can watch it, but you can only watch it once. And like in between all of the levels, there's like this like fuzz that's happening on the video. Again, this is the time what we're living in, is just videotapes. So while Steve Wiebe is like above and beyond the points leader, showed up and did it in person. Now we have Billy taking it away from him in the very next scene with a videotape alleging that he has actually gone to 1,000,000 points on Donkey Kong and is back on top as the leader, completely stealing the thunder from Steve Wiebe. Sorry, I had to set that up so that you could talk about what you were talking about next.
No, I mean, so that is, again, it just shows the corruption. It's that other people have submitted tape scores and they're not always accepted, but Billy Mitchell submitting his by tape, there's really no questioning of it at all. And that just shows the power that he holds over it.
And even when Walter is on the phone, like talking with him, he's kind of like giving Billy the answers that he's like, he's asking the questions like, Okay, so you did this in
Right.
okay. So you did that. So you did that the right way. Like it's kind of
Yeah.
like you're watching that conversation unfold, and you're like, yeah, like they're gonna give him the win without even questioning this, really. And that's the moment I think that you were about to talk about, is that this is where that tape wouldn't be allowed to be shown again. So Billy wouldn't let it be shown again. He just said, watch it once, because he didn't want anybody like really scrutinizing what they were seeing, because they might find out that he was cheating, which is what is alleged. They're alleging that he used some sort of, like, back in the day, now it would be easy to goof that, but back then there was some sort of video editing software that he used to goof him getting to 1,000,000 points. It
Is
might
that
not
what
have
it
happened
is?
in one game.
So I haven't like seen studied it too much, like the post movie stuff, but it is alleged that he actually tampered with the tape. I saw something where there was like he was using like an emulator where he was playing the game on like a different software and not playing it like on an actual arcade machine.
Right. There's other things that they talk about, like maybe the arcade joystick doesn't go four ways, but maybe it went six ways and you were
Yeah,
able
I think I
to
saw
go
that.
differently. So like there was a lot of different things that they were alleging. And then they'd have pictures of him back in the day, and there would be like the different joystick on the thing. And they're like, oh, well, the original Donkey Kong didn't come out with that. It was a yellow joystick or whatever. There's like a lot of conspiracy things about it. But anyway, I don't want Billy to sue us. I don't know if that happened for sure, but
It's all alleged. Yeah.
he's suing everybody right now because
That
Twin
seems to be
Galaxy.
his MO. Yeah.
Well, again, people with money like to scare you off. Like, okay, well, you don't have any money, so I'm going to sue you, and I know you
Right.
can't end up in court with it. But yeah, so he, again, God bless him, he's saying that he didn't do anything, and he's, fighting for it. And again, I believe he won against Twin Galaxies in 2020 about it.
Oh, okay.
Because also, but there's a more. There's like more lawsuits going on with other people.
Yeah, he does seem to be employing the strategy of just suing, sue first, ask questions later. And if you have the means to do that, unfortunately in America, that does lead to a success rate for a lot of people.
Yeah,
So.
and I mean, I'll just go on record here because he's suing somebody from YouTube right now, and I'm just going to say right now, like, we don't know if he cheated.
No.
It's alleged out there, so we're talking about it, but we don't know for sure. Billy, you could be the champ, as you say, and we know all we could do is assume that you are. But it has been alleged out there that he cheated back in the day, and that Steve Wiebe didn't get a fair shot. But if you look now with Donkey Kong, there's like been a ton of people that have beat this record since then, and
Oh, for real?
those
Yeah.
guys are far back on the list now. But he was the but these were the original champs, right?
Yeah. Oh, so good. I mean, to go back to the music, I love some of the editing with the scene that's starting from Roy Schilt with his trumpetize line, encouraging Steve to get back, cuts to his friend, tell him to go kick some ass, and then it cuts right to the You're the Best montage. I think that's such a fucking great scene, and again, it makes it so rewatchable for me. I love it so much.
I feel like they probably spent like a lot of the bulk of the money on trying to get those songs licensed for the movie,
I mean, there's so many great songs. I mean, did you notice the at the beginning with the song that he's whistling in M
I didn't.
In the Hall of the Mountain King? So this, you remember in M, like Peter Lorre, the song that he whistles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the song that's playing near the beginning when it's Steve Sanders and Billy when they're going and Billy Mitchell when they're talking about like how they met and how Steve Sanders originally lied and then they joined forces. So
Yeah.
that song is playing in the background and it's such a perfect song because like this is the joining forces of the antagonists of the film basically. So.
Wow, that's crazy. I remember you talking about that when we watched them. You're like, oh, I remember that first from seeing King of Kong. Now it's like
Right.
and I've known that you've loved this film for a long time. So it's really cool to see it and like understand why. Like, you're totally right. Like, this movie is awesome. It's so great. And also, like, a lot of like the graphics that are put up are like so, I think they're even like more crude than like the time period of 2005 like should be. Maybe that's on purpose, I don't know, but like they're pretty crude, like a lot of the graphics that are put up on the screen and stuff like that, and like the timelines and like following like the people and who they are, those kind
Oh,
of things.
it's definitely in the vein, in the style of 80s arcade games for sure.
I thought that was like on purpose, right? That was like kind of the aesthetic they were trying to go for it.
And it's like small stuff like that that really adds. Like when they're introducing the characters, they show Walter Day, they show Billy Mitchell, and the camera freezes and it transitions, their face stays and their transitions to footage or pictures of them, like from like 82. Back when they were originally working on the high scores, and like just like small directed style decisions like that just really puts it over the top.
Yeah, no, totally. And I love like all the interviews about Billy and like his characters, like his parents. Like, of course, his parents are gonna vibe for him. Like, he's great. He's always got something in his pocket. And like, people are like, yeah, he's cunning. He like, you know, knows how to have something up his sleeve. And, but yeah, it's always like his friends or like whatever that are like being interviewed about Billy.
His dad definitely looks like somebody you would find at the track on like a Tuesday afternoon.
You're right. He had glasses, like sunglasses on, I think, in his interview.
Billy Mitchell's a winner. He's just a winner.
And that's another thing. Like, again, watching this Alex Murdaugh thing, I like, you know, a lineage like that of like a grandfather. Like, who do these people learn from? You know, it's always the from their parents or whatever. Like, a lot of people can't break that cycle. It's like, okay, well, I was taught this way. And that's what's real. I can't become my own person because I was taught this way. That's a really hard cycle to break. So who knows? Who knows what Billy's father was up to, you know, in his career? I don't know, but we'll, maybe we'll have to dig into it.
Oh, so good. Like I said, like I remember first having that recommendation from John C. Reilly. I'm like, yeah, of course this is Reed Rothschild's favorite movie because the comedy and the sense of humor is so perfect with it.
Oh man, can you imagine if like literally this was like a real movie, kind of like how that scene does play out in Boogie Nights, where they're in like, where they're with Michael Mann in the recording studio, and like, yeah, John C. Reilly is just like so into that character of Reed Rothschild, like, you know, we're musicians and we believe it. Again, you like the belief of who you are and taking it to the extreme is like a pretty great gift an actor can do. Like, you believe, and even though like you're completely ridiculous and everybody knows like you're not good at music, you know, you guys say, well, have you heard the tapes? We're that good. You know, it's like, and then like, just like, that's why those performances rule, because like there's some people in life that like truly, truly hold on to that stuff. And they like, feel like they gotta never give up, even though they might not be very good at something.
And it's infectious and hilarious at the same time. Yeah. I think that's why it works so well. I could definitely picture You Got the Touch rocking out in this movie. It would definitely fit it very well.
Unbelievable. And even like Mark Wahlberg, who like, he has some music, you know, we're talking now about Boogie Nights, everybody, but he has some music obviously in him. To like sing off key that bad, like, it's hard to do when you're like, when you actually can sing, you know. I'm not saying Mark Wahlberg is the greatest singer. I know he was more of a rapper back in the day, but like, he's pretty off key in those. You got the touch, you got the power.
Well, so I definitely we're definitely going to cover Boogie Nights at some point in this podcast, so we can get into it then. But I've always wondered whether or not that's acting or that's genuine from Mark Wahlberg. In that scene, you know what I mean? Whether or not that's
him. Again, I don't want to get sued by anybody, especially Mark Wahlberg. So, you know,
No. I'm talking about him being an actor for that movie, for Boogie Nights, in the character for Dirk Diggler. But you're saying,
was he out of key on purpose, or was he out of key just because he can't sing?
Was that him like actually embodying Dirk Diggler, being like, all right, Dirk is most likely going to be a shitty singer, and so this is the performance I'm going to give for the character? Or is it part of it, like, he's just an okay singer to begin with, and that's what it is? I think it's more the character.
Too much credit for that. Like, if it was John C. Reilly,
I'll give Mark Wahlberg all the credit he deserves.
Well, but that's like his first movie, really. You know what I mean? You're saying that he's so into the character of Dirk fucking Diggler.
Well, it could have been P.T. telling him to do that.
Well, that's true. He's working with one of the best directors of all time.
Right. Yeah. So it's really more of, I'm not saying like there's like some like overly complicated way of doing it, but I just think that, you know, he was a singer, so he was obviously not terrible at singing. And so I think that for him playing Dirk in that scene, which works so fucking well, I think he's definitely playing it up as like,
well, I agree with that. He knows that Dirk, like, he knows they got to be bad musicians, so he's gonna I guess all I'm saying is, like, whether he can sing or he can't, it's really hard to like perform out of key if you know how to sing. That's that's my main thing. Like, you know, I'm not saying I'm the greatest singer in the world, but if somebody said, hey, can you do this whole take and do it out of key, I would have a harder time doing that than singing it on key.
I know you have a hard time sucking it up there, and you just fucking kick so much ass. So, you know,
I just wanted to pump up my next record that's coming. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's, I love that kind of stuff, and those kind of characters, and when they can go into that kind of stuff. But the fun thing about a movie like this is that these guys are real people. Like, you know, now it's kind of like the fun thing. Like, there, okay, so I also looked into it. There's a cameo
for Billy.
Yeah, for Billy, he has a cameo, and I watched a couple of his excerpts, and it's like amazing, because this guy knows, like, he knows every little thing he's going to turn into something that's monetarily, you know, lucrative for him here.
Yeah,
and he's even got like a hot sauce that's like the King of Kong hot sauce. Like,
I saw it. Oh, I need to get one of those bottles.
I know.
I can't believe I don't have it, to be honest. So. Yeah.
Right. Like, it's like you got to get a cameo almost too. It's like, what the fuck? $60 to have Billy, you know, tell you that never give up, you know? Okay.
I did see, you mentioned his Instagram. I had seen it before. One of my favorite pictures that I saw on it when I briefly scrolled through it was he was posing with Darth Vader. He's in this all white suit and he's just posing with Darth Vader. And the caption is just legends. It's like, yeah, two of the best like villains in movies of all time.
Okay, so like, here's the other thing. Yeah. I think on TMZ or something like that. Yeah, by the way, everybody out there, I check TMZ. I feel like that's the most reliable news source. I'm not kidding. I like watch it or I check it out every day. That's like where I get my news. I don't have television. I don't have anything like that. I log on to TMZ.com and I feel like they're the most reliable. They're like speedy on the news. And like, I'm up to date on everything I need to know. Anyway, TMZ today posted that Billy McFarland, the guy from the Fyre Festival shit, started a venture with the other guy that was in that documentary. So that Billy McFarland guy got caught for fraud or whatever and was in jail.
Yeah.
There was this guy that was in the Netflix series that was like talking about like how Billy McFarland said he had to go like blow the guys at like the border so that they can get like, you know, some stuff across the border. Those two guys teamed up in New York to make grilled cheese, like make a grilled cheese restaurant sandwich, like business venture. And that's what I'm talking. This is the same thing we're talking about right here. The public is like, isn't this fucking insane? They're serving, you know, millionaire kids the fucking cheese sandwiches at the Fyre Festival. Yet here we're going to go and like eat at his grilled cheese restaurant because it's like, we just can't help it. We just like, we're so stuck on it. We want to take selfies in front of like the grilled cheese restaurant that the guy from the Fyre Festival is fucking doing. And meanwhile, Fyre Festival guy is getting fucking rich. You know, that's our culture. And then all of a sudden everyone's like, how is that motherfucker so rich? It's like, cause he's smart and cause he knows you're stupid.
I can't argue with that. Yeah. I mean, grilled cheese does sound good right now. And if you can monetize it on social media as being the villain, it's not an uncommon thing. There's no doubt about that.
Well, there's like, that's a business route that many take. And, you know, again, like everyone can complain about like the Kardashians and they're everywhere and everything's like, well, you're fucking watching them. Like, you know, like you're the one who's like, funding this public display. I mean, you know, like that's what's happening.
I think the people who do watch them aren't necessarily the ones complaining about them as much. Oh,
maybe you're right, but there's a lot of people in the world that are complaining about like, how did this person get rich and how that, we're like, I don't know, people realize that this is what people want to watch, you know.
There's certainly no shortage of dummies to sell shit to. That's a timeless truism.
I mean, that's the thing about Woody Allen films back in the day. Again, you know, you kind of had to level up to him to watch his films. He wasn't going to dumb down to you. And that's why maybe it was like only a certain like criteria people liked Woody Allen films or got that humor, but he wasn't going to like dumb himself down for like any kind of like quick you know, fix for box office or whatever, you know. I mean, you can say whatever you want about him in his personal life, but that's like the kind of movies he always made, and he was consistent with it. You know, nowadays we don't need to get into the Marvel stuff and all that, but like, you know, there's a certain kind of business for making movies these days, and some people know exactly how to make the money on them, and some people are like, oh no, I want to make an art house movie, you know what I mean? It's like going to see Vertigo or going to see like what's like a big Marvel movie? I don't know. Like probably these days, nobody would go see Vertigo. They would go see.
What's Ant-Man. Ant-Man. Ant-Man's Ant-Man, the yeah. newest one.
And again, I enjoy those too. So I'm not shitting on them, but you know what I'm talking about.
Transition. I got a little Scorsese talk that we can go to. I feel like we've covered a good amount of King of Kong. Yeah. Anything else that we're missing?
No, I just really want to tell everybody out there who's listening, who's made it this far, thanks for listening, and go watch the movie. Like, literally, you're going to enjoy it. It's so great. This is a great recommendation by Pat for me. Two in a row, actually. Three. You've been kind of killing it with the recommendations. I mean, our Cage stuff is like, I never thought I'd see Mandy. I never thought I'd see King of Kong. And yeah, you're killing it. So we can move on. Go see the movie. Let us know what you think. I love reading people's comments. I seriously do. It's like, that's, oh, right, by the way, right. Just really quick before we switch.
Oh, hell yeah.
You're getting me this book, which is so fucking good. And I'm only like 5 pages in.
you can hear Tarantino's voice while you're reading, right,
dude? Yeah, 100%. And right. it's so the way we talk, it's so movie fan centric. People will love this book, and I, like I said, I'm not even barely past that first chapter, and I'm loving it. And that's why I love when people comment, because I know that you guys love movies just as much as we do. This fucking movie is so talkable, like we could talk for hours. Like, give us like, you know, your take on it. Maybe it's your favorite movie, and like, you've been thinking about someone to talk to about Mr. Awesome for years. Well, we're the guys. Let's talk about Mr. Awesome, you know.
Don't chumpetize yourself, get on it. So
yeah.
All right. Oh, awesome. Yeah, I'm so happy you enjoyed it, because yeah, like I said, it's always been one of my favorite documentaries, and we'll keep that going. Like I said, connecting it to American Movie, there is just a through line to it that I think is very valuable. You know, like all these great documentaries about artistic and creative endeavors. It's a beautiful thing. I love it.
Agreed. And yeah, again, this is like a movie that is just enjoyable. Like you can totally see yourself just like, it's an hour and 20 minutes, and you can, you know, sail away and watch without having to think too much about it.
Right. Love it. Okay, let's stay on books for a second. Yeah, I totally agree with you with Tarantino's cinema speculation, the way he talks about film. It really is something that I always think about. It's like, I mean, there's a huge difference between the way critics talk about art and the way artists talk about art. And Tarantino's always been like a very clear example of that. It's like he approaches movies in a way that's just very different from film critics. You know, like film critics will give accolades to his films, but then kind of not really mock his favorite movies, but certainly dismiss them. You know, not really looking, like one of his favorite movies of all time is Bad News Bears. And you'd be hard pressed to find like a professional film critic, whatever that means these days, who would put that like in their top 10 sight and sound list and whatnot. And it just really exposes just like how differently critics and artists talk about art. And I mean, I'm 100% on the side of like exploring the way artists respond to art, because it's a whole nother way of viewing it, a whole a lifestyle that is just, you know, true to them. You know, well, there is no, yeah.
No, I was just gonna say, yeah. And I mean, I love what you had to say. And I was actually talking about that the other day on how Tarantino kind of gets shit on for his picks of the films that he likes, but yet like he's influenced by them so much, and it's very clear in his films that he makes, and people are like, oh, this guy's a fucking genius, legend, which of course he is. But they can love his films, but they can't love the films that he likes. And, you know, he talks so much about that at the beginning on why there's certain, like, you know, it's like he's starting off talking a lot about 70s cinema and the movies that he saw when he was young. Again, I you know, I'm probably like whatever, 20 pages in or something, but just from the beginning of talking about like going to the films and like how a lot of them were violent and like how he, you know, his mom didn't mind that he saw those scenes. And he's kind of like explaining that, like, yeah, like this is what films do. They kind of like open up this world to you. And like, you know, also the way that people react in the theaters will influence how you feel about a film. And then like even talking about like some subtext in some of the 70s films that were like the gay subtext or like racism and things like that, depending on like what you heard from the audience, you know, it could sway you, or it would make you think a certain way. Maybe you didn't know exactly what this was about, but now the audience is yelling like a racial slur and you realize, oh, this is about race, or, you know, something home. There's a two people that like are in love, but I didn't really know until I heard like somebody yell in the back. Like, he even talks about like his stepdad was yelling, like, some, you know, again, we don't need to get into this whole book, but there is like right off the bat that like 20 pages in, this is the shit he's talking about. Like, this book fucking rules.
Yeah, I'm excited for you to get to his Taxi Driver essay, because that one's very, very illuminating about like just the movie itself and just like what he thought about it and why it was important to him. And that's the bulk of the whole movie. It's just him just going essay by essay about his favorite films and like how he was influenced by them. And again, like I was saying, like if you've ever heard Tarantino talk, it's fucking great to listen to hear him talk about movies, and now to be able to like read his writing about it is just on a whole nother level. So
yeah,
definitely. I knew you had to have it, so I was just like, this is, yeah, you got to get this at in your
pump. I appreciate that so much, and I just wanted to say I was at the New Beverly. I saw Amelie the other day.
Oh, hell yeah.
And we know, we walk into the theater, classic old cinema that Tarantino took over years ago, and it's very much, you know, we've talked about it before, put your cell phone away. Like before the film starts, they have the person that's putting the film on and says, okay, everybody, last week we had to ban somebody for life for bringing their cell phone out even once. Even when the previews start, I don't want to have to do that to you. Put your cell phone away. This is a cell phone free zone. We believe in film. They say this. We believe in film. We believe in cinema. And man, it's a great experience. And like, that's the cool thing about Tarantino, is he's so bold in he's unapologetic about the way that he wants to do things. And you feel it in his movies. You feel it in the way that he runs the cinema there. And you feel it for sure in this book. He's just kind of saying, this is how it is. You know what I mean? Right. This is my experience. You can write a book about your experience one day if you want. This is mine. Oh,
love it.
Okay. Love it. Sorry, let's get onto your Scorsese. You got a Scorsese thing you want to talk about.
Yeah, so staying with books. So the book I'm reading right now is Killers of the Flower Moon by David Grain. So I bought this 2 years ago. This is when I first heard that this is Scorsese's next movie. And I finally saw the pics come out. Looks like it's pushing 3.5 hours. It's going to be starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro in the same movie now. So it's like, it's a pretty big deal for them. But this, seeing the pics,
that was probably the only one that they've done together. This is
the first time that he's having his two, like,
Scorsese's two together in this boy's life, if you remember.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But working with Scorsese is definitely the unit is like why this is such a monumental movie to having them together now, like
Scorsese's two big, and
right, yeah. So when I saw the pictures, I was like, all right, I gotta get on it. And finally read the book this week, and man, I 100% see why this was something that Scorsese had to make after reading it. This came out in 2017. Not gonna give like anything away, because I'm gonna avoid all previews of how his style is, but I mean, the story is essentially about a native tribe that had land in the 1920s that ended up being oil rich. So it was a Native American tribe that ended up being extremely rich, and unexpectedly and out of nowhere, so they just start getting murdered one by one. And this coincides with an investigation, because they have money, so they have money to investigate it. This coincides with the rise of the FBI, which didn't exist before the 1920s. So
and there lies the Scorsese.
Right. And it was basically one of the first jobs for like J. Edgar Hoover to kind of lead the investigation of it. So it's the mystery of like why all these wealthy Native Americans are being murdered. I mean, why might be there, but like who's doing it? And then the rise of the FBI and seeing them come together. Man, I just finished it today, and I can tell you, like, based on knowing like who Leo and Robert De Niro are playing, this movie has the potential to kick fucking ass.
Dude, I gotta tell you, my girlfriend has not seen like barely any Scorsese films, so I get this is the nice thing, the lens of watching a film who has never fucking seen.
It's my favorite thing. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's part of the reason why I've rewatched so many movies. I'm like, oh, you haven't seen this? We're watching it right now.
100. Dude, you get giddy just sitting there being like, oh shit.
Right, right.
You couldn't even watch the end of Casino, dude. And like, who can? Like, even me now. I'm like, oh my God, like I can't watch this. It's so fucking terribly horrible. Again, fucking Tarantino talks about that kind of shit,
right?
And why it's important to have that shit in movies. I could talk on and on
the
about
the way they're holding Pesci's face, making him watch
man. I almost winced away here. Like, it's fucking brutal. She couldn't watch it, man. And she hasn't seen Goodfellas yet either. So, like, and then never seen Raging Bull, you know. I'm onto something good here. Like, this is, you know, because it's more for me almost than it is for her, because I just get so excited for somebody to watch these films for the first time. I mean, it's no secret that we both love Scorsese. So,
I mean, one of the most rewatchable movies of all time, Goodfellas. I'm excited for you then. I mean, I'm sure we're going to be covering some more Scorsese and possibly leading up to Killers of the Flower Moon. I don't see us not covering that. That seems like an essential pick for when that comes out. It's still undetermined. And so that was the other reason why I was bringing it up. So this is his first movie with Apple. So it's being produced by Apple, and it's undetermined, like, the release of it, like whether or not like it's going to actually even get like a wide release in theaters, because it may become like an Apple exclusive, like just direct to streaming. And so it was just when you were talking about like big budget movies and Marvel, it's like even Scorsese has trouble working with all the big movie studios these days, because for he's obviously one of the best directors out there, he's not a guaranteed like $500 billion box office draw.
That was so the interesting thing about, I think, you know, The Irishman, right?
Exactly. And that's why he went through Netflix. It was like he wasn't going to be able to make the movie he wanted with the traditional studios. And it kind of sounds like this would have been the same thing. And so that's like, it is just like a changing environment with movie making, as it always is. But like, it is pretty bonkers that somebody like Scorsese can't do like what he wants to do unless he like plays the game in a certain way and finds the studios that actually want to work with them, which is always a changing thing, you know?
Interesting, because, you know, Scorsese in his early career, I was like able to make films on like no budget, right? Like, you know, the Boxcar Berthas, and, you know, I think that was a Roger Corman production. So the man knows how to make a movie on no budget, but he's like, you know, the twilight of his life and his career, he's probably like, fuck it, I'm making the movie I want to make it. Somebody will give me the money, because do we have another director that it is as influential as Martin Scorsese? And like, to film, you know, I mean, I don't even think you could say like Coppola. Like, Coppola has kind of stopped making films, you know, but everybody knows him, of course, for the films that are legendary. But living right now, like, you can't say De Palma, you can't say Coppola. I guess you could say Spielberg, but Spielberg's in a different realm than him. Like, the guys who, I don't know, we're living in a time with some great, great filmmakers, you know?
No, I mean, what makes Scorsese unique is how I think he's still making some of the best movies he's ever made. Like, The Irishman is legit one of my favorite movies of that decade, of the 2010s. I fucking love The Irishman. Wolf of Wall Street and The Departed are way up there. And that's what's kind of unique for him, is that like he,
that's true.
it really is just mind-boggling, but like he was making absolutely essential movies in the 70s and he's still fucking doing it now in 2019, when The Irishman came out.
Right. And arguably maybe like some of his best films, right?
Yeah. Which is, I certainly don't know, or can't think of any other director. I mean, like we were just talking about The Fableman. So yeah, like Spielberg is obviously a fucking legend and he's still like making amazing films, but you know, Fableman is, you know, is not quite Jaws, but you know, like Scorsese's just always, he's staying like at the top of his game. And
That's the differentiator, and I couldn't really put my finger on it, because here we're talking about De Palma. De Palma is to me one of the greatest directors of all time, but hasn't really made a film in a while that has really, like, I don't know, maybe like the last one I thought that was really interesting was Black Dahlia, and like not even, you know, like then you got Spielberg, who does have Fablemans, right? We loved it, but like, you know, everything kind of before that. Like his last three or four, I haven't really watched. I didn't even go see, you know, like, why is that? I don't know. Like maybe he doesn't have the potency that he used to, but every time you hear that Scorsese's coming out with a film, you're like, I'm there. I'm in that seat.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, it is certainly a little bit less frequent. Scorsese makes, certainly fewer films than Spielberg. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, all I'm trying to do in my mind right now is just try to figure out why he's, I love him so much, but like, you know, it's not really anything to figure out. It just is. Yeah. Speaking of De Palma, I rewatched Snake Eyes a couple years ago with
Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage, not his best, neither of their best, but pretty fucking fun movie though. This is the one from like '99. It had that like 15 minute opening shot, which was like what was like the big seller on it in the boxing arena, where it's like, yeah, this 15 minute shot just setting up the whole movie with Nicolas Cage and Gary Sinise and all the characters. Pretty fun still. Pretty, you know, it definitely got enough De Palma and Cage style to it. I definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's a lot of boxing stuff in Black Dahlia too. I mean, De Palma at his best to me is like Blowout.
I haven't seen Dahlia, so
I mean, it was good. I, you know, yeah, again, I liked it.
Can't
forget Untouchables, of course. But yeah, anyway, we could go off on a tangent about them. I think we'll have to cover. I'd love to do like a double feature of Body Double and Blowout. Those are two films that were suggested to me by our engineer when we were recording the Scissors Records. Never heard of those two movies. One with John Travolta, and Lithgow and stuff like that. Like, these are, have you seen?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. So we should
cover those. And you have seen them now.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were saying you still haven't seen them. You're saying when you were back in the day, they were recorded. Yeah. Blowout. I think he might have a chapter on Blowout in that book. That's definitely one of his favorite movies of all time.
That would make sense because it's like in the 70s realm where he's talking a lot about the films that, again, I've only been 20 pages in, but so far it's like a lot of like 70s film that he's talking about.
Yeah. No, Blowout is, I feel like that's one that in the last like 10, 15 years, people are realizing like how influential and like how that is one of the best movies of the 70s, just in terms of like what he was doing and how influential it was. So
yeah, Travolta's great in it too, you know. So it kind of became something different.
It's been a long time since I've seen Body Double though. I would need to rewatch that one. So
which one?
It's been a long time since I watched Body Double though. I would definitely have to rewatch.
So a young Melanie Griffith in that as well. Anyway, I go on forever. Really great.
Hey, this is a never-ending conversation. So
yeah.
All right, you want to do music?
Yeah, let's get into our music recommendations.
Nice. Oh man, I loved that Chad Tripper song with Lit. That was great. It definitely made me, I re-listened to a couple songs from the Lit album, and more of Chad stuff as well. And I came across, I saw on YouTube, I watched Lit's video for Miserable. This is the one with Pamela Anderson.
Yeah.
It's like the most 90s This is like 1999 distilled into like a single video. The band's like literally playing on the body of Pamela Anderson. It's so fucking great. It's such a great time capsule. I had such a great time rewatching. I was like, man, I mean, because that was an album I realized, like, I was like in like middle school. It's like I listened to that album a lot, and so hearing those hooks again, it was pretty fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff kind of like weaving back into stuff, and I kind of like that about Chad, that he kind of like get like, I don't know, these are bands that like he paid attention to when he was younger,
yeah,
and now he gets to be able to like work with, and that, like, that's such a cool revelation.
Oh, yeah.
This band that you loved that's playing on Pamela Anderson, like, I can make a song with now. And
it's like Tarantino casting Travolta. It's like, these are the people you grew up by. He's like, oh man, of course I'm going to utilize you,
right, dude? Totally. You know, yeah, like, to get that kind of shit going is kind of a fun part about life, you know. Like, I don't know, I heard the other day that Tom, our drummer, you know, is going to do this benefit at back in Chicago. Actually, I don't know if you know about it, like Kostubes.
I saw that. It's at the Bottom Lounge.
Yeah, I did it. Yeah. I did that event in 2019, and then the pandemic happened and everything, and so they didn't do it for a while, but now they're doing it again. And anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up is because Art Alexakis is playing, you know, from Everclear. And like a few weeks ago, my girlfriend and I were listening to Everclear, and we're like, oh fuck, man, these guys are kick-ass song, you know. He hadn't really listened to it in a while, but like, we're listening to the records, and we're like kind of going down memory lane, and I was like, yeah, and this guy's playing with Tom, like, you know, in the middle of March. Like,
yeah.
But I remember, like, that was an untouchable rock star back in the day. Like, it was all over the fucking radio. And, like, I would have never thought in our wildest dreams, like, any of us could, like, be on the same stage as that guy. But here we are.
Love it. I mean, hey, the 90s. I mean, we're in the throes of, like, 90s nostalgia, for lack of a better term, but like, it's seeing the best of what came out of that decade. It was an incredible decade.
Well, it makes sense too, because like, what was like with Stranger Things popping up, it was like all 80s shit again now, right? So now it's like 90s shit. So I don't know what's next, like Beverly Hills 90210, kind of like you know.
It's usually 30 year cycles. So you just go back 30 years. That's kind of the trends that reoccur. Because people who grow up in it, they end up being of more influence. And so, like, if you were 13 in the 90s, now most likely you're in a position of power to lift up those voices that may still be coming from the 90s or influenced by them. So,
wow, that's I would have never thought that. So, see, learn something every day. but do you want to know what my pick is for
song? Please, I'm excited.
I've been thinking a lot about, like, records that I like played the shit out of, you know, and like why. And there's a band called the Menzingers. You ever heard of them?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Back in 2017, they released a record called After the Party. Have you ever heard that record before?
I mean, I know I've listened to several other records. Little names that are not off the top of my head.
Lyrically, these guys are like, dude, bar none, you know, like so good. And I've listened to this record so many times, and I was like, oh, what song am I gonna have? And I was like, well, what are like some of my favorite songs of all time, like in the last like decade? And the one that I'm going to talk about today is one of them. And the reason that being is because I feel like the Menzingers are like the same age as me. And the reason I like to talk about this record is because the record starts with like their song, it's like, what are we going to do now that our 20s are over, you know? And this came out in 2017, and he's kind of talking about, you know, we're out of our 20s, we're growing up. It's like, it's called After the Party, right? Like, after you're done kind of like going out and drinking and stuff, like, what's life like? What's it like to grow up? And I think the reason that this band is so potent is because, like, a lot of times, like, you know, if you follow trends, like we talk about all the time, you try to like play to your audience that was at one point listened to you when they were 15 is now 25 and they don't relate to you anymore. And then even less so when they're 35 and you're playing the same shit, you know, it's hard to keep an audience, except I feel like every time the Menzingers come out with a record, they're putting out a record that coincides with life and like what it's like to live it in the current state that their fans are in. Right. So this record especially really, really hit, you know, in my 30s there. And I love this song called Your Wild Years, and I wanted to talk about a couple of the lyrics. This is my pick. It's called Your Wild Years from 2017's After the Party by the Menzingers. And like this, I think this is the third verse almost, or maybe it's the second, but anyway, these are the lyrics. We drove up to Massachusetts together. Your old house was just like you remember. We stayed in your adolescent room and rummaged through the boxes labeled former you. The souvenirs of happiness in the moment, your wild years that you often mention, the sands of time in an hourglass that you're always begging for back. I got drunk in the afternoon with your father in the living room. As the television broke the silence, you smiled, know that I was trying the best that I can do. Okay, so why do I love that? He's like going somewhere with a girl that he's like in love with, but he doesn't really know about her past. But he's going to her home, her adolescent room. They're staying there. It's awkward. We've all been in that situation. We've dated somebody. We're older now. And the connectivity that we have to each other's past aren't the same. My girlfriend that I had in high school, well, we know that life and we knew all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. The girlfriend that I have now, luckily, was around back then. We weren't dating. So she knows a little bit of that era. But like, most people don't have that. Most people don't know who you were at 20. Most people don't know who you were at 30 if you just started dating them at 40, right? And I love this passage because he's basically saying, you know, you smiled knowing that I'm trying the best that I can do. I'm sitting here having, you know, getting drunk with your father in the other room, trying to make small talk, trying to figure out who you like, and here we are at your place, you know. And these like rummage through the boxes labeled former you, like brilliant lyrics. Your Wild Years, the Menzingers. Listen to it, enjoy it. If you've heard it before, listen to it again. It's worth listening to this whole record. This is like a record that needs to be heard in its entirety. And there's some videos that are really great too, like especially for the last song, After the Party. This band is fucking great. This record is probably their pinnacle, but every record is great. The one they came out with after it is great too. And this is a band that was a slow burn for me. They recorded some of their first records with Matt Allison at Atlas, which is where the Scissors recorded our stuff. So I kind of like heard about them first through them, or through Matt. And then they, you know, they've kind of taken off and they're on Epitaph now. So I'm crossing my fingers that one day I'll be able to work with them somehow, because I love them. But yeah, that's my pick.
Love it. Yeah, so I'm looking at it, After the Party from 2017. I've definitely listened to this album. I'm looking at the cover right now that triggered my memory. And
yeah, it's a pretty memorable cover. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember responding really well to it. So I'm definitely excited to re-listen to Your Wild Years on that one. Awesome. That's great. I mean, and yeah, hearing those lyrics, that sounds fucking fantastic. Love it.
It's just life, man. You know, I like hearing about life. Like the good, the bad, whatever. Like, that's why I'm just not a Disneyland fucking guy. You know, it's like, you can't like tell me that everything is like happy all the time and like expect me to like believe it. You know, I get it that like people like to like escape into that and like be in La La Land, but I want to hear about life, man. You know, I want to hear about the real shit. And this record is chock full of that, especially in those years when you're trying to figure it all out. You know, I don't think anybody ever figures it all out, but at least it feels good when you have someone singing back to you that's trying along with you.
Oh yeah, I love that. Yeah, you don't need Disneyland, you got Florida Project. That's all you need. Yeah. Oh, which, holy shit. Okay, so I gotta go see Cocaine Bear. Yeah. One, because it looks amazing. Mooney from the Florida Project, the main girl in it, she's in the movie. And this is also the last movie with Ray Liotta.
Yep, I know. I haven't seen
it yet. Like, I mean, I was going to, Cocaine Bear, this is right up my alley. This is my type of movie, or horror comedy. So anyway, but having those two in it, I'm like, yeah, I got to go definitely check this one out. So
my girlfriend did this like improv thing, where it was called like Tournament of the Nerds. And she went up at this theater here called the Hayworth, which by the way, has great history. It's the theater where Rita Hayworth and her family like first started out before Rita Hayworth became Rita Hayworth. Troupe of dancers, and it's the theater that they use in La La Land, where Mia like performs. Ooh. Her like one act show. Anyway, to say that I was stoked to be in that fucking theater is an understatement. But my girlfriend got to perform on that stage, and she did this thing where she like was Ace Ventura, and she had to go up against Cocaine Bear. So that's
I've seen her Ace Ventura on Instagram, and it's fucking great. It's definitely it made me realize I haven't watched Ace Ventura both of them in a couple of years, so I need to rewatch those. So
totally, and the way she kind of like, you know, had to like prepare for it, she had to know a lot about it. Was before Cocaine Bear came out, so anyway, I know I'm going off a little bit on a tangent, just that she went up on stage, performed against Cocaine Bear, and it was like amazing because like that's why we started watching. She's like, who does a lot of cocaine in the movies? I was like, well, Sharon Stone and fucking Casino. And so that's why we started watching Casino, so she could like read up on like the character of Sharon Stone, so she could talk about that like against Cocaine Bear. Like, you know, yeah, like Cocaine Bear, like, you know, we've seen it before when it was called Sharon Stone and, you know, Casino. It was pretty cool.
Or the last 30 minutes of Goodfellas with Ray Liotta rocking the best cocaine shit ever, which is, you know, kind of poetic that this is his last movie now. So I'm so excited for us to cover Goodfellas. I can't wait.
And we got to like obviously talk Cocaine Bear when we both see it. I don't know, again, why I haven't seen it. There's like a right here on Sunset. There's a light up. Like I haven't seen it in, like this before. There's this like great, it's a, on Hillhurst which turns into Virgil and Sunset, there's this like really gnarly light. But the cool thing about this really gnarly light is like there's like five like intersections that like kind of merge, and there's always like the brand new movie, like, you know, what do they call it? Bills, like that they paste on the side of the buildings and stuff like that. So you always have like advertisements for what's coming out. But the Cocaine Bear one is up right now, and it's like a light box. So like Cocaine Bear is like lit up from the street at night. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. And it's, I didn't realize it was directed by Elizabeth Banks, the actress, which is, I did not expect a movie from Elizabeth Banks to be a Cocaine Bear. So
I think Ant-Man beat it at the box office. That's what we were just talking about, right?
Ant-Man definitely beat it at the box office, but not by much, which is a huge thing for Cocaine Bear, why it's doing awesome and why people are not as into Marvel as they previously were. So
there's a little like a thing where Tarantino says in the book, he's like, you know, one movie that he was watching, I can't remember the name of it and I hadn't seen it, but he's like, the character dressed up as an ape and then got punched in the balls, and he said immediately knew that this movie was for me. And that's kind of like the thing is, like, when you have like a title like Cocaine Bear, it's like, yeah, I can fucking see Cocaine Bear. Like, I got to go see that. Like, it's, you know, it's going to be a wild, fun time.
That's how I felt the first time I watched Razorback. So I was like, yeah, this movie's for me. So
totally.
All right. So what I'm listening to this week is an artist I fucking love. We've talked about him a little bit in the past, Rocky Erickson.
Oh, yeah.
Remind me, how familiar are you with it?
I'm familiar, yeah. So yeah. You made a playlist, and I got to listen to those songs. We were going to cover Rocky, I think a documentary about Rocky.
So I got it right here. So You're Gonna Miss Me is an amazing documentary on Rocky Erickson and his life. I wanted to cover this after we did...
Daniel Johnson.
Yes. It would have been a good double feature with that, but this is a great documentary about his life. He started with the 13th floor elevators, basically it was the absolute forefront of psychedelic rock. And he's just an amazing voice. His solo career, I love so much. It really balances the act of like him writing about love songs and then writing about the devil and aliens invading his head. It was just like such a good balance of what he was writing about and the spectrum of his songs. And I love his music so much. So the song I'm picking today is Nothing in Return from his 1986 album, Don't Slander Me. This is more in the vein of a love song with garage rock and power pop stage of his career. The Evil One is a great collection of his songs that are more like horror tinged. I mean, if you're into like the Cramps or the Misfits, definitely fits right in there. But like the other half of his career is kind of more throwback rock and roll lyrics about relationships and love. And it's kind of a lost love song. Such a fun tune. It's not one of his more popular ones, but it's definitely one of his better ones, I think. And he's just a artist that I fucking love. I've always enjoyed him. I was able to see him a couple times perform before he passed away in 2000.
You said at the Elbow Room, right?
Not the Elbow Room. The Empty Bottle.
Empty Bottle. That's right.
Yeah.
Empty Bottle. Yeah.
I think it was two times I saw him at the Empty Bottle. I think he played like Wicker Park Fest.
Great fucking actually. Venue, dude, by the way, to see.
Yeah. That. Oh, I love the Empty Bottle. Yeah. Very small. And so, and it, I mean, this, it all goes into the documentary, like, cause he was off the radar for so many years. He was institutionalized, incorrectly institutionalized and subjected to electric shock therapy, which just made him even less in touch with reality. It's a pretty tragic story of his experience with that, but he was able to, with the help of his brother and a few other people in his family, he was able to like get back control of his life and started making music again. And he did release an album with Okkervil River just a couple years before he passed, which is a great album. And he was touring the last couple of years of his life. So like I said, I was able to see him a couple of times. And this, a lot of this is really covered in the documentary. This is why it's one I would love to cover one day. It's not available anywhere. Like it's completely out of print.
The DVD is that's like, why I don't think we covered it because I was just watching.
So, I mean, I bought the DVD a long time ago because I love the film. It's not available to stream anywhere. A DVD on Amazon is like $75 for the cheapest, so it's definitely one that's not available right now at all. So hopefully it will return to streaming or something. We can maybe cover it, but in the meantime I wanted to cover put some spotlight on his music and especially this song. And and as we were talking like documentaries, now this is just one I would love to get people more to watch, but obviously that might not happen for a little bit now until that.
Must be,
but his music is always there, and like I said, he's an artist I absolutely love.
Yeah, I just maybe something to do with the rights to the music within the DVD or something that there's probably fighting on or something.
I mean, there's lots of shit. I think we are going to cover Airheads, which I would fucking love to cover, but it's not available to stream anywhere. The Brendan Fraser, Steve Buscemi, and Adam Sandler classic from the 90s. You can get a DVD some places, but like it's not available to stream anywhere. It's just, you know, physical media is a real thing that I think a lot of people, and I'm putting myself into it, so I kind of jumped the gun. I'm like slimming down my physical media collection, assuming that like most stuff will be available in the future. And as we're seeing, like, it's just not the case. I mean, we're getting to a point where like stuff that like comes out that came out like on streaming services and never really got a physical media release is now unavailable on those streaming services. So it's like, not only are that you can't not stream it, it's physical media for it didn't even exist in the first place.
Or you could stream it if you pay the plus membership of the streaming service, right? I can't fucking stand that shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's if it's even available.
Well, right. But either way, if it is, it might not even be on the service that you pay for because you have to pay for the premium part of the fucking streaming service. I don't know, man, it's nuts. But you're right. That's why it's good to have that physical media still. And that's cool that I love that you have that. And I also love knowing that it's like $75 for it. But, you know, you're the one who like was smart enough to hold on to that because you love Rocky so much. And so I like that this is your pick for the week.
Hell yeah. Oh, so good. Like I said, like this is in his like kind of power pop almost phase. You know, he had a lot of different styles over the years. And like I said, like with his influence on psychedelic rock. And he's like just a lost voice in rock and roll. Like his voice is so fucking great in all of his songs. And whether he's singing about love or about zombies and aliens and whatnot, it all sounded good.
Hell yeah, dude. Fuck yeah. I love that. Cool. Well, we got a really great playlist really growing here. You got your addition of these to them this week will be, I don't know, man, we've got like, I don't know, over 20 songs probably now in there.
We're pushing an hour and a half now, music. So I think we our intention is to have the greatest jukebox playlist for anybody's party. Because there's definitely a lot of versatility. And even if it's not that, I mean, just revisiting this and see where it goes from here. It's like, this is like such a great combination of music between you and I.
And speaking of the tie that binds music-wise between you and I mean, there's a lot of similarities of things that we like, but speaking of the man, the myth, the legend, the LA King, Warren Zevon. I voted for him the other day. I vote almost every day that I can for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I don't give a shit about that stuff. I don't give a shit about, Rock and Roll Hall of Fames or whatever, but I give a shit about Warren Zevon. So I am voting for him just because I fucking want to have everybody talking about Warren Zevon again. I just like think that that is a great thing. And I'm sure you're doing the same. For anybody out there listening, Warren Zevon is up for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame status, which he is very much deserves. And if you listen to this podcast enough, you realize we do love Warren Zevon very much. And it looks like he's doing pretty well. I think he's in third place right now. And I think that's enough to get in to the Rock Hall, I think. So.
Is it just I don't pay attention to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at all. Like when I heard about Zevon, I just Googled sometimes. I mean, I watched when The Cure got inducted, and I sent you their
That's
great
great.
interaction. Like, oh my God, The Cure's here. Are you excited? Well, not nearly as
That's what
excited
you
as you
want.
are. So it was like the most Robert Smith response to a fucking an overzealous reporter as possible. That's why The Cure's perfection.
Great.
I watched Eminem's speech. I didn't even realize he was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I thought
Watch
that was
that.
really cool. No, I mean, yeah, I just haven't paid much attention to it. So it's like, how many do you know how many they I saw the list of the nominees.
Yeah, I'm
Is
not
it
exactly sure, but there is like the way that the voting goes, it's got like the top people that are like going to get in if like it
yeah.
stays that way for the voting at the end of the day. And then underneath it is like the people that I think aren't going to get it. So it's like there's like a white box and then there's like a black box, and the black box is like the people that are like not in the lead. And Zevon's definitely in third. He has been since I've been voting, at least.
Nice. They also saw Joy Division, right?
I think so. Yeah, but I don't think they're at the top. So I mean, I have to look again. I can't remember exactly all the inductees, but like you said, I don't pay too much attention to it except for the fact that again, just want to hear like about Zevon, I just want to hear it.
I'll dedicate the next 3 months of my life to if more people are checking out Warren Zevon and he gets the rightful appreciation that he does for being such a fucking legend. So.
Yeah, I mean, they're amping up the social media presence for him big time, I've noticed. I mean,
Hell yeah.
they were fine, like with it before, and every once in a while, you'd see something, but I think they knew that this was a big deal. So I see Jordan Zevon posting a lot too, and then the official Zevon like Facebook or whatever will share it, and it's always cool memories that Jordan's got of his dad, and I love that shit.
Oh, so good. I heard Lawyers, Guns, and Money the other day again. Such a great song.
Dad, get me out of this.
Oh,
All right,
please, please, please cover Zevon one day. I'm begging you, Darren. So,
Oh man, I did. There is a version, and I could send it to you, but I don't want anyone else to ever hear it of Splendid Isolation that I did cover. It's
a great
fucking
fucking song.
terrible. I did it in like 2006,
Oh,
and
no shit. Back then, because I
man.
remember what like the first week of lockdown, you just sent me a link to Splendid Isolation. It's like, what a perfect fucking song to be listening to in the first week of lockdown
Oh,
for
about
COVID. So,
putting tinfoil up on the windows,
oh, so good.
Michael Jackson, like a fucking guy to sing like that, like Michael Jackson and Disneyland, don't have to share it with nobody else, lock the gate, Goofy, take my hand and lead me through the world of self. Fucking guy.
Beautiful,
Yeah.
beautiful.
Well, on that note, we got to end this episode because we could talk about all of these things for years and years and years. We got to let everybody put down their headphones and go watch King of Kong because, that's the movie we were here to push. And I loved it. Thanks for bringing it to my attention, man.
Hell yeah, happy to talk about it. Like I said, one of my favorite talks. So, the more people watching it, the better. very happy you had such a great time watching it too. Cause yeah, like I said, I've rewatched it so many times, and I definitely expect you revisiting to see Billy Mitchell and Mr. Awesome on all their charisma.
Absolutely. All right, man. Well, cool. Great talk, and we'll see everybody next time.
See ya.
See ya.